Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Thanks for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast, bringing you philosophy for our times. Here at the IAI, we're committed to taking philosophy out of dusty books and lecture halls and into the heart of public life. If you enjoy this debate and want to carry on the discussion, or watch over 1,000 more debates and talks on all the latest issues in philosophy, science, politics and arts, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
Good morning, everybody. Now, what about my body? My body is mine. Definitely mine. Three great speakers are going to help us work through this topic about the possession of our body. Anne Phillips, who's Professor of Political Science at London School of Economics and Professor of Gender Theory at the LSE Gender Institute. And she's the author of Our Bodies, Whose Property? John Harris, here on my left, Professor of Bioethics and Director of the Institute for Science, Ethics and Innovation at the University of Manchester. Throughout his work, he's defended what's called a consequentialist approach to ethics, and he's the author of How to Be Good. And on my far left, Brooke Magnanti. Brooke is a scientist, blogger and writer, who's best known by her pen name, Belle de Jour. Her books were adapted into the TV programme Secret Diary of a Call Girl. But our first opening question, which is for all of them, but in turn, and starting with Anne, is should we be allowed to do what we like with our bodies?
I mean, these are our bodies, and we do have rights over our bodies, particularly rights to bodily integrity. But I don't think that that means that we have the right to do whatever we like with our bodies. And I think one of the things that particularly concerns me is that when we do use this language of ownership and property to capture our relationship to our bodies, it can encourage the kind of the view that we have some kind of absolute authority over our bodies, or that all that matters in terms of determining whether particular practices or activities are okay is whether the individuals involved in them have given their consent. And that's not my position. And I'm sure we'll roam over a number of examples in the course of our discussion, but just briefly to give you two. If I donate my blood, it's my blood, but I don't have the right to determine who actually gets that blood, and I certainly don't have the right to say I want my blood only to go to people who have the same skin colour as me. So it's my blood, but I don't have the kind of the authority to determine that kind of use of it. A second, more kind of complicated and probably more controversial example, if I suffer from dwarfism and I'm offered a job as the ball in a dwarf throwing competition, I don't think it's just up to me whether I accept that particular job or whether it's kind of okay. I mean, this is a real example, and I'm sure it's quite a lot discussed in the literature, and I'm sure some of you know about it. It comes from a kind of municipality in France where some bright spark came up with the idea of a dwarf throwing competition in which strong-armed men would kind of compete with one another to see who could throw the dwarf in question furthest. And the local council banned these events on the grounds that it was an affront to human dignity. Now, the dwarf in question was in fact quite indignant. You know, it was his body. He was happy with the deal. You know, there was quite a lot of money attached. Why did anyone else have the right to kind of, you know, to interfere in this and decide that it was an affront to his dignity? And, it, you know, he sort of pursued it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now, I wouldn't argue this in relation to notions of human dignity, which I don't find a particularly illuminating notion in this context, but I do think there's an issue about third parties. I think in that case, if in that case, as seems plausible to me, that these competitions have the effect of constituting people who suffer from dwarfism as, in a sense, less than people, as things, as objects, as kind of toys to be thrown around, It seems to me that that's a problem, and that the fact that the individuals involved were happy with the arrangement isn't the only consideration. So it seems to me that, you know, of course we have the rights, lots of rights, to do what we decide over with our bodies, but we don't have absolute authority.
Thank you. John, what's your take on this question?
Well, I don't think very dissimilar, but I'd like to start by saying I don't think this, what we can or cannot do with our bodies is a matter of ownership. I think ownership is inappropriate in this context. If we can do things to and with our bodies, it is not because we own them, because they're not the sort of things that can be owned. And that, I think, is probably the gist of a lot of what you were saying, with which I agree. But let me start in a different place. We, all of us in this room certainly, are particular sorts of creatures, very particular sorts of creatures. That particularity has been defined in many ways as curious creatures, as sort of creatures for whom science is important, rational creatures, as self-conscious creatures. But most importantly, we are the sorts of beings that create ourselves, for whom our own lives are an enterprise that we shape to the best of our ability. And this we do, whether self-consciously or not, by the choices that we make, by the decisions that we make. We are constituted by our past choices and our past decisions, and we are the sort of person who wants to make particular sorts of decisions in the future. And that broadly is to say that we are autonomous, that we are choosers, selectors, and for me, our control, insofar as we have it, over our bodies is a function of what is required to respect the sorts of creatures we are and to let us flourish as those sorts of creatures. So that's the broad framework within which I'm working. A couple of things more, though, I would like to say about that. One is just to remind people that that doesn't, and I agree very much with you, that doesn't mean we can do absolutely anything, that our choices are completely untrammeled, as John Stuart Mill famously said a couple of hundred years ago. Well, I'll give you actually roughly his words, but paraphrase them first. My freedom to extend my arm stops somewhere short of your nose. And more formally, the way it's usually put these days is, every person is entitled to the maximum liberty that is compatible with a like liberty for all. That is to say, every person is to have the maximum freedom of choice, freedom of action, freedom of decision making, which is compatible with others also enjoying that same liberty, that same autonomy, that same freedom. And I think that sort of framework is much more useful for thinking about what we can do to and with our bodies than others. And of course, because we have duties to others, we sometimes have duties to use our bodies for their benefit, including, of course, by organ donation and in many other ways. And finally, just to give you a sense of how I, for example, apply this idea in a quite different context, I think it also applies to decisions about the end of our lives, whether we are entitled to end our lives when we choose to do so, and if so, why. And I want to illustrate this by just offering you what I think is, if not a true proposition, it is a proposition that recommends itself to reason, and I am sure it will recommend itself to your powers of reason as well. And that is, there is only one thing wrong with dying, and that is doing it when you don't want to. That's the only thing wrong with dying. If you were to be offered a devil's bargain now, yes, you're going to die, but only when you want to, and never when you don't. You'd be crazy not, literally crazy not, to take that bargain, because it doesn't stop you dying, but it gives you a choice. And from that, if that proposition recommends itself to reason, then it follows that doing it when you do want to is not a problem. If the only thing wrong with dying is doing it when you don't want to, then doing it when you do want to is not a problem. It shouldn't be a legal problem, it shouldn't be an ethical problem, it shouldn't enter into anybody else's decision-making, because while every man's death may diminish me, my death diminishes no one.
Thank you very much, John. And Brooke, you'll go with that question.
I think we can all agree generally that just the framing and the word ownership is probably a very difficult one and probably not a very appropriate one, but we do disagree on some points. My choice was to do something that society deems unacceptable, which I find morally neutral, or to give up on finishing the science degree that I'd been working towards, and that was unacceptable to me. And there's quite a lot of opposition that you see often when we're talking about, you know, the discourse around coercion, where there's vocal opposition to disadvantage people making such decisions because they are assumed to have been coerced. In my experience, this often stems from an unexamined revulsion towards the specific issues that are being discussed, such as disability, such as sex work, and that these are often very strongly rooted in religious and status control, but then get framed as, because I would not choose it and I am a reasonable human being, therefore it is not a valid or a good choice. To kind of contrast this, you know, many people widely accept, in this country anyway, the nuance of the arguments surrounding pregnancy terminations and abortion, that we know that in many situations it is a constrained choice, that it is not an ideal choice, but that the ideal of every pregnancy being planned, being wanted, and also being viable is something that does not exist, and that we shouldn't be punishing people because their lived experiences do not conform to this ideal that doesn't exist. One of the things that bothers me when we talk about coercion is quite how often, not that it necessarily does, but that it often can replicate racism, classism, institutional sexism, xenophobia, and colonialism, but under this umbrella of being concerned about other people's choices, whether they're disadvantaged by where they happen to be born, or because of institutionalized racism and sexism, or if they have a condition as brought up by Anne, such as dwarfism. The proof of harm is what especially concerns me, and this is where I'm getting into my material self as a scientist. I want to see the numbers, and very often when you do see the numbers in these discussions, proof of harm is revealed very quickly to be following cargo cult science. It's found scientifically wanting and produced by people without a grounding in population statistics, epidemiology, or anything else that would make it scientifically valid. I mean, there are so many decisions, and I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, from the rather the simple and mundane obesity, body modifications, cosmetic surgery, but also the very private ones such as end of life or gender confirmation surgery and family planning and reproduction. We have a problem when governments respond to these kind of public conversations claiming that there's a demand for policy intervention, and who does that serve? Well, it underlines the desire of status to have control over the one thing we all unambiguously have, which is a body.
Thank you very much. Is the rights and the limits of rights over the use of the body for you? What's the sort of bottom line of justification?
Well, for me, it's equality. And I see, I think, a lot of the uses that people make of the notion of human dignity, when you kind of peel away all the kind of confusions around dignity. I mean, dignity is used in all kinds of very meretricious ways. People, you know, the kind of Catholic Church used to talk about the dignity of labor, the dignity of motherhood, in ways in which dignity seemed to become this thing which meant that you had to do something that you didn't want to do, but you got dignity for it. So I have a kind of like resistance to the notion of dignity, though dignified people are absolutely fine. But I think if you peel away what people are trying to get at very often when they talk about human dignity, what they're really saying is human beings, it's a relatively new idea, we're supposed to think of all human beings as of equal significance and worth.
Yeah.
And that kind of equality brings with it both certain rights that we all have against kind of arbitrary power and so on, but it also brings with it responsibilities in relation to others, and that there are ways in which some of the ways of, in a sense, using some people for the kind of the amusement of others, it seems to me you can describe that as an affront to human dignity, but I would describe it much more in terms of undermining the fundamental equality that we're supposed to be committed to.
Right, that's interesting, because that's an idea almost of coerced equality. is that how you'd see that? What would you think is the ultimate justificatory thought with respect to the use of your own body?
Well, the normal limiting case is the idea of selling yourself into slavery, or indeed donating yourself as a slave. And why it's a limiting case is because that is unlike... I mean, all decisions are irrevocable in a certain sense, because if you decide to do something at time T, then you can never do some other thing at time T. So all decisions are irrevocable. And if we were forbidden from making irrevocable decisions, that would be pretty tough on us all. So it's not the irrevocability of selling yourself into slavery, or indeed choosing your own death, that is the problem. It is preempting your continuing as a particular sort of being,
right,
the sort I outlined at the beginning.
And Brooke, you gave an example of something which I'm sure some people would think gets close to that idea of selling yourself into slavery, which is sex work.
It's just renting time. It's
right,
time because, and access
because
to
as well, you have time away, in which the slave doesn't have the time away from the condition. But does it, as it were, during the time, does it have the same status for you as a...
Not in my experience, it doesn't. Obviously, when we talk about sex work, this is an umbrella term for all kinds of work, and I think probably in this context we're referring specifically to full-service prostitution, which is what I did, but even in and of itself, this covers a wide variety of activities, of which what I did was of a particular kind. But, you know, nevertheless, the fact that there were limited options available to me and to many other people does not cease to exist simply because people object.
But what do you think of John's thought that certain things, for example, selling oneself into slavery, is a kind of limiting case on what one could think of?
I mean, selling oneself into slavery seems to be probably the most extreme case,
right,
and far less extreme than sex work in a way. Because when we're talking about, you know, what is the thing that we all have and the thing that we all have as a body, that does seem to be, for all of us, the baseline of the thing you cannot give away or trade for something else in you know, the absolute sense that somebody's absolute ownership of that. For people like me, whose experience of sex work was relatively benign, I saw it mainly as giving a service, and that 90% of that service wasn't actually about the sex, but about making someone feel a particular way.
Yeah.
A bit like what people do for free when they go on dates with people they don't intend to see again.
One of the things, though, you did say was that, as it were, it wasn't just an ordinary piece of voluntary choosing because of the considerations which you were bringing to bear in terms of the rest of your life.
I mean, the other things that I had considered, and again, you know, using myself as an example is probably a very poor way to debate, but I'm going to do it anyway. The other things that I considered were things like selling my ex. I was in my 20s at the time and a very good candidate for doing something like that, which, of course, in the UK is not legal, but would have been in the United States, where both sides of the transaction in prostitution are illegal.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to IAI.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper, get the philosophy behind the news, and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Do you think, John, maybe you listening to this, do you think that the sort of argument that Brooke's using there belongs with your self-realisation thought, that, as it were, there were limits to self-realisation due to economic circumstances, which meant that a sort of retreat from that project was needed in order to make possible
sure that in the way that Brooke has described it, it necessarily involves a retreat. I don't think it seems to have involved any sort of retreat for you. It was a decision which, under other circumstances, you might not have taken, but...
But so would being a genetic epidemiologist.
So exactly. So would, you know, for me, talking here, we all do all sorts of things which are not totally optimal.
I think, Anne, your position is in a certain way the least individualistic, as it were, in the sense that you have to see something beyond the individual to make sense of these rights. Do you regard that as, in some way, a way of protecting people from themselves, from their desires? What's the relationship there between the...
I mean, I think a lot of the discussion gets kind of misdirected because people think that what's at issue is either individuals have the right to decide or we have a paternalistic kind of intervention, which is protecting individuals from the harm that they may do themselves. There are lots of bits of paternalism that I don't object to. I don't object to being made to kind of wear a seatbelt in a car. I don't think addictive drugs should be available in the supermarket. You know, so there are bits of paternalism I have no problem with. But generally, the issue for me is not about paternalism.
Right.
It's about, as I say, it's much more about third parties. It's about the way in which our individual actions and individual choices are part of a whole set of social practices which can sustain and reproduce unequal relations. I mean, if you do anything about kind of thinking about sort of gender relations, sort of power relations between the sexes, it's clear that there are all kinds of social practices that we all participate in, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, which are part of what reproduce those kinds of inequalities, similarly with racism. And it seems to me that that those are the kind of concerns that trouble me, the ways in which individualism, again, like paternalism, isn't all bad. Individualism isn't all bad. Lots of ways in which we all want to have the right to decide for ourselves. But if you make it just a matter of all that matters is what the individuals are choosing, you fail to take on board the sort of the sense in which the social practices that we engage in have all kinds of ripple effects for the other people in our society. So it's that, it's not the paternalism, it's not the protecting individuals from the harm they may do themselves, though in certain instances, as I say, I don't mind a bit of paternalism.
When discussing the failure of the war on drugs and whether particular drugs should be decriminalized, and then once decriminalized, in what form will they then be legally available?
Yes.
Right. Because of course decriminalization is not ever an end point with any of these issues. We then have to think about
is it available on the supermarket shelves?
Is it available on the supermarket shelves, or do you go into a clinic? Yeah. How is it administered? Yeah. Who's in charge of quality control?
When we talk about possession in the case of one's own body, in a general way, it's not this contingent possession where it just happens to be mine and could be somebody else's, like my pen. And I think, John, at the beginning you said you were unsure whether you thought we should talk about possession in the case of the body. What would be we can't really stop saying my, I don't think, my body. Is it, as it were, how we're to understand that as something other than possession?
Possession isn't the only linguistic relationship we can have with something to make it meaningful. So, in a way, I don't see your problem. If something radical happens to my body, it may be profoundly different than it is now in ways that will also make my life profoundly different. So I had one sort of body and now I have another sort of body and so on. They're both still mine in a sense, not in the ownership necessarily or possessive sense. A lot of people actually want to alienate themselves from their body because they don't like the body that they have. So I think there are all sorts of, if you like, relationships one can have with one's own body.
In the case of bodily self-transformation, one would still think there's a difference between what I might want to do to my own body and any rights I might have to do that to somebody else. And how for you does that idea of, as it were, the freedom that you want to give the person in projects of self-realization and the way that will bring their own body in, why should it stop there?
Well, largely because if it didn't, you wouldn't like the consequences, which is, of course, the deterrence theory.
But if you get
put
rid
on
of
a personal level.
If you get rid of ideas of possession and a very special sense of possession with respect to your own body, then how can you get leverage on the idea of not liking it?
Well, you have, I think, in some extreme cases, you have to take a view about whether what happens to the body is a good thing or a bad thing, and if it's a bad thing, how bad a thing it is. We have debates like this, interestingly, in disability studies, where people want, they have a particular disability, they want their children to share that disability because it, for them it is a part of a particular community. And sometimes we, society, have to take a view about whether it would be permissible to, if I am deaf and I want my child to be deaf, if it happens not to be going to be deaf, am I entitled to deafen it?
Right.
And so on. And that would go for all sorts of bodily manipulations as well. But they are very difficult decisions and might well have to be taken on a case-by-case basis with a very elaborate argument about the consequences of permitting or denying a particular community to self-identify with how their bodies are, and so on.
And if we could put this back to you, that we had the idea of equality rather than self-possession being at the forefront of your thinking about bodily integrity and so on. Does the idea of equality for you shift us away from thinking about the body as some kind of possession, or does it treat it, as it were, just as any other possession? How does the body figure?
It does shift it away. I mean, I think there's a lot of confusions we get into, as John indicates, with the use of the word my.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I say my son is my son, I certainly don't mean he's my property and that I can do what I like with him.
Right.
In fact, I count myself lucky
if
he ever
takes
any advice from me. Right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not a certainly not a kind of like a control or an ownership. So partly the word my, I mean, obviously my body is mine. And I do think that carries certain implications. And I think there is something about the way in which we inhabit our bodies. I mean, I think it's a mistake, you know, that people sometimes fall into, to think of the kind of the body as this housing
yeah.
of the real me, which is what kind of mind, soul, I
right.
don't know what, you know, we live in the world through our bodies, we engage with people through our bodies, if we change our bodies we change the way we relate to people, so there is something about the sense in which we inhabit our bodies, we
yeah.
are our bodies, we're in
the
non-contingent possession,
yes, no,
as
so
you
then
say.
There's an interesting yeah. problem there that, yeah. that comes in with the amputee, the prosthetic and so
yeah.
on. I mean, that inhabitation seems both non-contingent, as it were, unless you want
yeah.
to invoke an idea of an immaterial
yeah.
soul
yeah.
or something, and yet there seem to be contingencies in there too. An interesting one that came up recently was about head transplants.
Yes.
So the one way of putting it is, say, you keep your body, but we're going to change your head, right?
Yeah.
But that sounds more like a body transplant, as
yeah,
it were, because
yeah,
we
yeah.
like to think of ourselves as seated somewhere up here rather than...
Well, we do have experience of facial transplants and of hand transplants, and indeed people do report that they find this quite troubling, right, because there is a sense in which with somebody else, what seems like somebody else's hands or somebody else's face, there is a sense in which people don't quite know who they are anymore.
Right.
So we do have all kinds of attachments to our body, which I think the kind of the amputation doesn't sufficiently capture, that make it very, you know, make it very hard for us to make this clear separation between me,
yeah.
me and my body. I mean, if I kind of try to imagine who I would be if I'd been born with a black skin rather than a white one. It's a different me, right? It's a different kind of world. It's a different way of relating to people, a different way of people pigeonholing me. So there is that. Possession definitely doesn't capture it.
Okay, we've run out of time. We should thank Anne, John and Brooke very much for their contributions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast. If you enjoyed this debate and want to carry on the discussion, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.